Today is our last in-class lecture, and we'll then have the final exam on Monday. Final exam will be, we'll cover everything in the course. So mainly focus, as we talked about last time, just sort of focus on the material covered in lectures and make sure you understand that material, and we'll, the questions will be drawn from that material. And you can also look online at last year's final exam to get another example of what final looks like. So today I wanted to talk about an example, sort of put all this together and show you how we put all the different technology that you've learned about, how we put that together into a real speech processing system. We actually talked about this a little bit earlier in the semester, but I have a more, we did that less formally. So let's spend today's class and just talk about this problem of recognizing speech. And this is actually, even though we'll talk a lot about the speech problem, these techniques have been applied to many different areas of signal processing now. So really, as we talked about earlier in the semester, just about any time you have a signal and you have sequences of events in those signals and you have some knowledge about those events and you want to build a pattern recognition system that converts your knowledge about those events into statistical information so that you can do a better job of pattern recognition, that's really what we're talking about today. So let's try to focus more on the higher level issues related to the modeling and pattern recognition and stuff, and less on some of the details of speech recognition itself. So there's been a, over the past 20, 30 years, there's been a pretty dramatic improvement in speech recognition technology, primarily due to the introduction of hidden Markov models. Hidden Markov models give us a way to model not just the spectral variation in the signal, but also an ability to model the temporal variation in the signal. And we can do both of those, modeling the spectrum as a function of time in a very nice, compact hidden Markov model. And we can do all this in a statistical framework. The many, many years ago, it was in the 1980s when artificial intelligence was popular. People were trying to build machines that could emulate human behavior or human performance on speech recognition. In fact, in those days, we used to look at spectrograms, which is a time frequency display of the speech signal. And if you know enough about speech, you can actually look at the spectrogram and you can figure out what somebody said. This is called spectrogram reading. It's not unlike what a doctor does when he looks at, when a radiologist looks at an X-ray, or a doctor looks at an EKG, or a security worker looks at a polygraph. I mean, people have this ability to look at these signals and draw, make inferences about various conditions. And how they do that is really interesting, because not only do they look, they're essentially taking their knowledge about the problem space and applying it to their interpretation of the signal. So for a few years in the 80s with artificial intelligence, people thought, well, let's just build machines that could read spectrograms. And they literally worked on algorithms that would try to emulate how humans read spectrograms. But by the late 80s, statistical techniques were beginning to emerge. And all of that, all of those expert systems being built under the guise of artificial intelligence were replaced by statistical machines that were actually quite simple. You throw the data at them, you do lots of training, and out comes a really high-performance system. And that marked a major transition in speech recognition research. Now, that success subsequently found its way into many other fields. It first migrated into natural language processing, where people now started to develop statistical techniques for taking sentences and parsing them up into nouns and verbs and adjectives and things like that. So the entire field of natural language processing was reinvented using the statistical approaches. But then it went even further. It went into fields like information extraction and machine translation. And so state-of-the-art machine translation systems today, for example, they take what are called parallel text. If you've noticed on the web, sometimes you can find web pages that have an English version and another language version. They take these parallel texts and they build a machine that can essentially learn how to translate from one to the other. And they use a statistical approach that's very much similar to the kinds of things we talk about. And then, of course, you have things like Google searches, information extraction. All these techniques really kind of grew out of the success that people saw in the 80s with problems like speech recognition using hidden Markov models. Now, more recently, there have been other, you know, the field has advanced. You hear a lot more about support vector machines. We now view speech recognition more as a problem in what are called finite state transducers. And we use a lot of information theoretic techniques to do language modeling. And we'll sort of touch on some of those today. We also, however, formerly used to use just generative models, the same kind of Gaussian models that we've studied in this class. But within the last 10, 15 years now, we've gotten to the point where we can also train those models using the discriminative training approaches that we talked about a little bit in this class. So a state-of-the-art system today does several passes of generative training, and then it does additional passes of discriminative training. And you can almost always improve your error rate doing a little bit of discriminative training. Now, the fundamental challenge in speech recognition, and I'll talk about this a little bit more, is that you never have enough data. So you're always trying to generalize from your data. And we've talked throughout the semester about that. If you have a small amount of data, you want to build a pattern recognition machine that works well on other data representative of that application. You always run the risk of overtraining if the data set is small. And that's a problem that we always face in speech recognition. Even though we're up to processing now tens of thousands of hours of data, still that's a problem. So at a highest level, speech recognition is essentially an information extraction task. And this is actually this picture we made up in the mid-1980s, actually. That's how long this representation's been around. But one way to think about the speech recognition problem is we start with a signal, we convert it to a spectrogram, we then take the spectrogram and figure out what phonemes are present, we then take those phonemes and we build words, we then take those words and we build various concepts, we try to understand things like part of speech, we try to understand things like who's the actor, who's the receiver. So in this case, we have doctors and patients and body parts of patients and those kinds of things. And when all is done, what comes out in the top is what we call a logical expression, which simply defines the information present in this utterance in some kind of formal language that we can then use, we can operate on using formal language theory and such. So we used to call this the speech recognition problem, going from speech to words, or the speech-to-text problem. This we used to call the speech-understanding problem, trying to actually understand what the intentions are. And the difference is really pretty simple. If I ask you in a telephone transaction system, do you want to make another phone call? You may say yes, you may say no, you may say uh-huh, you may say I think so. Well, the yes and no are easy. From those answers, we know what to do. The I think so now makes it more of a speech-understanding problem. Or, you know, maybe. Or someone says maybe. So speech understanding is really what we're after ultimately, because you all expect machines to understand your intentions, not necessarily what you spoke. This is particularly true in applications like travel planning. We've done a lot of work over the years in travel planning, and travel planning is really interesting because if you have a good secretary, and I know you all are young, you haven't had secretaries yet, but if you have a good assistant, maybe your spouse or your significant other, who does your travel planning for you, they get to know you. And you can just say something simple like, I need to go to Boston next week. And they'll know exactly what flight to put you on. You know, if I say I'm going to Washington, usually that means I'm going to fly out of Birmingham, I'm going to fly out in the evening, and, you know, this and that, and a secretary can handle all that. That's what's good about speech understanding. The system understands what you really want, not what you're saying. But when you're working with a system that, like a telephone transaction system, you're calling up an airline, they don't have that kind of familiarity with you. So it's much harder for them to provide a very efficient interface for you. So we constantly struggle between speech recognition and speech understanding, but most problems ultimately become speech understanding problems. Now, the traditional outputs have been things like the best word sequence, and another very important output of this process is time alignment of the information. And this is another aspect of speech recognition that people did not appreciate early on, is that not only can we tell you this word occurred, but we can tell you that that word occurred at this point in the utterance. Because as the process of building our hidden Markov models and all that, we actually describe the data frame by frame. Every frame of data is attributed to a particular word. Now, it's interesting to me that early on, in the mid-80s, I would say we didn't consider that so important from an application point of view. But, of course, in the world today, that now has become very important because you want to sit on the Internet and you want to say, show me all the news reports that talk about President Bush. And you want those reports to come up and you want them to be indexed into the point in those reports where they talked about Bush, and then maybe back off a few seconds so that you get some context. This is called keyword searching. And that's become a very hot technology. Google, in fact, has been finally beginning to release some of this. And there are other companies that offer similar services. But indexing of information is very important because it allows you not, in a document, not to just know that that word is in the document or that piece of information, but it actually tells you where in that piece of information, where that information is in that document. And if the documents are big, like a half-hour CNN broadcast, and I don't know if you've experienced it with video, but it's really frustrating searching for video on the web because you get these hits. But then you still have to spend a lot of time going into that document and figuring out where that hit actually occurred. So another very important piece of information is the time alignment so that we can index into the documents and find the piece of information that we're looking for. But as we've talked about this semester, there's a lot of other things that you can output. You can output word graphs. Show me what words were probable at each point in time, so I can see the alternate choices in the event that I make an error. We can output things like NBEST. Show me the NBEST sentences that we think that utterance contains. So this might be the overall best choice, but there are probably some variants, like the doctor examined a patient's knees, or the doctor there'll be some obvious alternate choices. A doctor examined the patient's knees. And so forth. And we'd like to see all of those alternate choices because sometimes when we don't get the correct choice as number one, those alternate choices might actually contain the correct choice. And then we've talked about other things such as confidence measures. We'd like to know how confident we are that each one of these words occurred at that point in time. And then even more so with problems like speech, we'd like to know something about the identity of the speaker themselves. And we can actually build pattern recognition systems that detect things like prosody. Is your pitch, your fundamental frequency going up or down? Typically, for example, when you ask a question, what do you think? To make it sound like a question, you raise your fundamental frequency a little bit. Well, monitoring people's fundamental frequency can tell you something about the intention behind what they're saying, especially in a conversation. Speaker accent. You'd like to know about dialects, accents, and things. And then we also do things like speaker recognition and speaker verification. Can you spot a particular speaker in a large body of audio? That's a very important application. If you're looking for persons of interest, for example, and you happen to be monitoring telephone calls and things, and this is one of the primary applications of this technology in the intelligence community is when you're in a military setting and you're monitoring large amounts of audio data, you don't have time to listen to it all. So you'd like the ability to be able to find particular speakers or find particular words or those kinds of things. And these are the kinds of applications that we actually work on in this area. More recently, a couple emerging areas that have gotten a little kind of interesting. One is this notion of deception. If you've ever, I don't think anyone here has probably ever traveled to Israel, but the Israeli airports are world renowned for their ability to spot what they think are terrorists. And not to overplay this, but their security personnel, they have to be constantly on guard because there's a high, it's a very volatile area, as you all know. Well, they're considered the world leaders in the ability to interview somebody face-to-face and determine if you're lying. And you do this by have you seen the show The Mentalist or some of these new TV shows that are picking up on this stuff? If you watch some of these new TV shows, they're actually starting to do this. There's a show called, I think it's called The Mentalist. The Mentalist is one where he looks at a lot of different body language and Lie to Me, this new one, is built on this exact thing. He can look at your face and figure out, you know, just by the way you twitch or something, whether you're being honest or not. Well, this is a skill that actually people like the FBI and such learn these kinds of skills. So people have been looking at, can we build statistical signal processing systems that can take audio and actually determine if someone's being deceptive? And to some extent, we can always do these things to some extent. The question is, how well can we do these things? And deception is a pretty difficult task. If you've ever wondered about fingerprint identification, when they take your fingerprints and they match them against these large databases, that's another type of application of this kind of technology. So we also, in my lab, we worked for a while on fatigue. We were working in an application where they wanted to monitor pilot communications to determine if pilots were too tired to be flying. These were pilots who were flying very long missions from the U.S. to Iraq and back, and they would be flying for like 18 hours one way or 18-hour round trips. And you want to make sure that at some point in that trip, they're not too tired to be flying. So you like to, or if an airline pilot happens to have had too much alcohol, you could build a system perhaps that could detect whether someone was too intoxicated to be flying. Now, what makes this problem so challenging is that the way we actually talk does not match the way the dictionary says we should talk. So if you look up the words that are spoken here, did you get much back? And you look those up in a dictionary, it will tell you what sounds each one of those words should contain. And then if you actually look at what happens when someone says this kind of a phrase in actual conversation, well, you never really say, did you get much back? You often will, in a really kind of relaxed conversation, you'll hear someone say, just. The did you get will just be just, chidja. And typically, we've actually measured some phoneme deletion rates on data like this, and phonemes, about 12% of the phonemes the dictionary says should be there will actually be deleted when you speak normally in casual conversation. About 1% of the syllables will be missing. And we used to do a really interesting demo of this with, I think it's actually on our website, with the word, one example in particular that we used to show was the word task, T-A-S-K. So I would play that word for people using telephone bandwidth speech, which is limited to 4 kilohertz of bandwidth. And I would play that word task. And I would ask them, well, did you, tell me what sounds you heard. Well, I heard T-A-S-K. So then I would play them the word sound by sound. And they would hear, over the telephone, they would hear T, they would hear A, they would hear nothing, then they would hear K. And they'd be amazed by this. Now, why were they hearing nothing for the S? Well, they're hearing nothing because S is a high-frequency sound, and its frequencies are actually above 4 kilohertz. So when you looked in the spectrogram, there was actually nothing there for the S. But yet, we very clearly perceive the S. Well, there's a couple reasons for that. One is you perceive the influence of that sound on the A, on the preceding A and the following K. And then second, in your mind, you're so sure that word is TAS that you're filling in the sound. And they've actually done experiments on this. I think it's called evoked potentials or something. But they've shown that if people believe a sound should be there, they can actually measure some neurophysiological signals being induced to offset the fact that that sound isn't there, because you're so sure that that sound is going to be there. And they've actually done some experiments where they have people looking at someone's lips while they're talking, but then they drop the audio out. But you're so sure, because you're seeing the lips move and you're hearing the rest of the sound, that sound should be there. So the models that we use for this kind of task have to be very robust to missing data. They have to allow for phonemes to be deleted, or you'll never recognize real speech. From the language modeling side, we have a similar kind of problem. When you go through grammar school and you write your little essays for your teachers, if you ever write a sentence for your teacher that contains three A's in a row, what's your grade school teacher going to do? Zap that sucker, right? That's ungrammatical. So we were transcribing this conversational speech, and we started doing the same kinds of things. We said, well, no one's ever going to say the same word three times in a row. Well, guess what? We found out in conversational speech, they sure do it all the time. Have sort of like, manpower. So if you build a language model on text produced from written speech, you will never see these kinds of things. And that's generally the way we like to build language models, is we like to pull down text from the internet and use that to train give us an idea of what words are probable, what word sequences are common. But written language and spoken language are two different things. And casual conversation is a completely different thing in itself. I think we've talked through the semester, the most common word in conversation is things like, uh-huh, I know, mm-hmm. You know, those are, so, we want to use grammatical structure to improve our ability to recognize speech. We want to use that kind of knowledge. But that kind of knowledge is almost always imperfect. It's not the way, it doesn't describe the data in reality. And that's true across a lot of applications, but particularly true for language, because language is so fundamental to our existence as human beings, and we use it to communicate, so we deform it. And I'll talk a little bit later about new words and things like this. So we've talked about this throughout the semester, that in the early days of speech recognition in the 1950s, two guys, Peterson and Barney, they did a landmark study that said, if you look at the resonances in the spectrum, the peaks of the spectrum, and you plot the first peak versus the second peak, we call these Forman frequencies, you will be able to determine which vowel was spoken based on the frequencies of those peaks. And they did this for a large number of subjects, and this was considered a breakthrough, because they showed, oh, look, the vowels are all distributed very nicely in this space. Now, what kind of data did they do for this? Well, they did CVC type data, consonant, vowel, consonant, cat, dog, had, hid, hoed, very controlled. And they found that there was very little overlap. Well, when you do the same thing on real speech, conversational speech, for example, what you find out is you got a blob. All these sounds look the same from a frequency content point of view. Very, 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 very large degree of overlap, because the sounds are being influenced by the preceding and following sounds. Your articulators, when you're speaking, if I'm going to say the word cat, even when I'm saying ka, I'm thinking about ta, and I'm positioning my mouth for that. Your articulators, it's a dynamical system. It has inertia with it. You can't stop your tongue on a dime. So there's a lot of inertia that blends these sounds together, and that's something we call co-articulation, and that's what generally contributes to all these features being in a blob. So one thing, I think one of the basic things I want you to take away from this course this semester is how, in a situation like this, where your error rate is going to be very high if you simply do classification on these features, how did we learn this semester to separate, to get better performance on such a task? No. You could use SVM, you could use neural network, you could use PCA, you're still going to get a very high error rate on that data. So what have we learned this semester? If I hand that problem to you, you should immediately think, okay, I know the solution, or I know a way I can get better performance. What? Shoot, what? Shoot? So this is a plot of the feature vectors for these particular sounds, and there's significant overlap. So what are some of the things that we can do to get better performance? No. The overlap is real. No matter what you do, these blue points and these yellow points are going to overlap. There's no transform that's going to unlock those and, some really weird transformation. The overlap is real. The overlap's a problem. The overlap gives you a high error rate if you just do static pattern classification on this kind of data. So what is our general approach? You've learned a lot. We've spent a lot of time this semester actually discussing this. So what are some of the things we can do to get a better error rate than if I just do... So first I will say, yes, if you do PCA, if you do SVM, PCA will give you a line, SVM will give you something a little better. You can get a little better performance. But you're always going to have an error rate because there's overlap. So how do we go about separating that overlap out? What kind of statistical tools can we invoke to do that? Okay, Bayesian, good. What do we do with Bayesian? What? Prior knowledge. So one thing we can do is ask which of these sounds are more probable from prior, a priori probabilities, prior probabilities. And that's essentially what we do in speech recognition. We try to predict what the next sound is going to be or what the next possible sets of sounds are going to be. So we can weight those probabilities much higher than sounds that we know simply can't occur. So we use essentially context to disambiguate those features. Instead of using the absolute values, we try to use conditional probabilities. We condition those probabilities based on preceding sounds, based on other types of knowledge, grammar and syntax and such. And that's a process that you should be doing in almost any pattern recognition system. And that's what this course is about, exploiting that kind of information using priors, using more sophisticated Markov models and such. But all these things together have the effect of allowing us to separate those features based on context. So the way we do this in speech recognition draws on what's known as the noisy communication channel model. And in this model, we essentially think about the communication problem as I have a message in my head. You are going to receive a message when I speak. So I have a message that's transmitted. There's a message that was received. The message that was received is invariably going to be different than the message that was transmitted. For example, when I say, oh, the final exam is going to be easy, you hear, oh, the final exam is going to be hard. When the politician says, I will not raise taxes this year, you hear, He's going to raise taxes. So there's a message sent, a message received, and those are different, and those are corrupted by noise. And we like to view that noise as a sequence of transducers. There's a message. I convert the message to words. I convert the words to sounds. I articulate those sounds and create the sound pressure wave. That wave goes over a channel that has ambient noise and such. Then you hear that those sounds and convert them to, you convert that sound pressure wave to sound. Then you convert that to words. Then you convert that to meaning. And we think of each one of those processes as some kind of transducer that adds a little bit of noise. And therefore, we model this in, as sort of a classic noisy communication problem, and the goal, and we use a criterion where my overall goal is that the message you receive and the message that I send are as close as possible. And that's sort of what we do when we try to do maximum likelihood decoding. So for speech recognition, we break this down using Bayes' rule as the probability of the words given the acoustics is equal to the probability of the acoustics given the words times the probability of words divided by the probability of the acoustics. Our objective is to minimize the word error rate by maximizing this probability. Our approach, well, we have a couple things we can do. We can't do much about the evidence. We've talked about that. We can do something about this. That's the probability of the acoustics given the words. And we can do something about this, the probability of the words. The probability of the words we call the language model. And that we can train from text, representative of our application. So we can go off and do that offline in essence, and that's prior information. The acoustics, we sort of talked about this semester, that won't really contribute directly into this until we talk about things like discriminative training. But the probability of the acoustics given the words, this is another very significant consequence of Bayes' rule. There's a big difference between these two, namely that probability of the acoustics given the words means I ask you to say a word, and then I measure the acoustics. So I can model, I can compute that probability because that's under my control. I can tell you to say these words, I can compute the acoustics. The probability of the words given the acoustics, however, is much different. That means I need to know all possible acoustics that could have generated those words. That means all speakers, all environments. Well, that we'll never know. So the use of Bayes' rule actually has a really fundamental impact on our ability to train pattern recognition systems, because this is something we can do through training data. We can collect data, we can transcribe it, and we can then train models on that data. And then that allows us to approximate this probability by forming this probability. So our general goal in maximum likelihood training is to maximize this term and this term. And we tend to do that, we typically do that independently. So we've talked a little bit about how we can think of that from an information theory standpoint, and we talked about entropy and mutual information. So when we look at the Bayesian model, then, we can sort of break the problem down into these four blocks. We have acoustic front end, which takes a signal and converts it to features. We have acoustic models, which map those features to words. And we then have a language model, which tells us what sequences of words are probable. And then we have a search engine, which allows us to, for a given utterance, to find the most likely combination of acoustic models weighted by the language model probabilities that gives us the highest overall probability. Now that in conceptually seems simple, but if you think about the fact that we don't know where words begin or end, and if you think about the fact that we may have a million words in our vocabulary, people actually for conversational speech use about 2,000 words most frequently. In newspapers and such, they try to keep they don't use too many infrequently occurring words. They use about 20,000 words. And if you read the front page of Wall Street Journal, you need about 20,000 words to understand that. There are new words which arise every now and then, but generally about 20,000 words. But a dictionary may contain about 600,000 words. So if you think about that, every frame, every 10 milliseconds, we could have potentially 600,000 words starting. And at every frame, not only do we have 600,000 words starting, but we have 600,000 words continuing from the previous frame. And from the previous frame, and from the previous frame. So it's an exponentially large, or the exponential growth in the search space. And that's why we have to be very good about search. And we do that using some very powerful, what are called beam search methods. So this just sort of lists this, the components of that problem. Now, I won't say too much today about feature extraction. We've done over the years just about every possible signal processing approach you can think of. It doesn't really matter in the end. I think I have. The most common technique we use today uses some Kestrel analysis. It uses first and second derivatives of the features, and this is what we call the MFCCs, or the Mel frequency scaled Kestrel coefficients. We actually utilize rudimentary models of human perception in the way we do a nonlinear warping of the frequency domain so that the features match the logarithmic behavior of human hearing and all that. But this is a fairly mature process. There's an alternate front end that people use based on some knowledge of human hearing. We do some equal loudness, loudness intensity type corrections and things. Gives very, very small improvement in word error rate, but we do have features which are very heavily influenced by the way human hearing works. For quite a few years, people were focusing on this. But the bottom line is, no matter what features you use, when you look at them in the feature space, there's a lot of overlap. We also can do some noise compensation. We talked a little bit about some of this in the adaptive signal processing class. We have ways to do to try to separate the speech from noise. And we also do things like vocal tract length normalization. This is kind of interesting. One of the things we would like the system to be independent of speaker, but every speaker has a different physiology, which means the resonances in your spectrum are going to be shifted slightly. So what we actually do during recognition is we try to guess what your vocal tract length is. And we do that using a probabilistic search. And once we guess, it's sort of a maximum likelihood approach, once we guess that vocal tract length, then we normalize your spectral data by that vocal tract length. This is called vocal tract length normalization. And we do this not only on the means of the features, but also on the variances of the features. Now, the acoustic models that we use literally look like this. We have three-state HMMs. You have a beginning state, a middle state, and an end state. You have self-transitions and a straight-through transition. That's for every phonetic sound in our system, we use those models. Now, early on, we used what were called monophone or context-independent models. We had one model for every sound in the human language, in the language. English, for example, has about 40 to 60 phonemes. But we actually get much better performance if we use context-dependent phones. So we actually use phone models that are conditioned on the previous sound and the next sound. And this is another thing that even though we do this in speech, I think it's applicable to a lot of other fields. So that we try to take into account the influence the neighboring sounds have. So we actually have about 10,000 of these models that describe the 10,000 most common three phone sequences in a language. Now, each one of these models has a Gaussian mixed gear model associated for the output distribution. And our feature vector has 39 elements, so a single Gaussian is going to have 39 elements for a mean vector and 39 times 39 elements for a variance, for a covariance. Well, 39 times 39 is too much. So we restrict the covariance to be diagonal so that we limit the number of parameters at each state. Even so, we have 39, so we have basically 40 plus 40 elements or 80 elements per Gaussian, and we may use as many as 64 Gaussians at each state. So we have 64 Gaussians times 40 elements, times 80 elements, times 3, because there's 3 states per model, times 10,000 models, millions of parameters. And that's one of the reasons why we need large amounts of data to train these systems. Training is a very, very much an iterative process. A typical training run for a system that we would use has about 40 passes over the data. So it's not just 10,000 hours of data, but it's 40 times that, because you're going to go through that data 40 times during training, just one training run. And we will start often with a simple system, and then we'll bootstrap it up. We'll go from monophones to context-dependent phones, then we'll go to mixtures, and then we'll go back and retrain everything once we have it all. So you don't just start with your most complicated system and train it from scratch. We actually bootstrap the system step by step, and that's why we need the 40 passes. Each one of these passes typically needs no more than about 3 passes. The EM convergence is very fast. So we only need to do about 3 iterations at each stage, but we need to do multiple stages to build the system up to be very complex. So this is sort of what it looks like. We start with a single Gaussian, and then we split it 2 ways, and then split the 2 ways to 4 ways, and then split the 4 ways to 8 ways, and that kind of thing. And then with each step of this, we do a re-estimation of the entire model set across all the data. So mixture splitting is actually pretty expensive computationally. I'll skip that. We actually use decision trees to cluster the states in these HMM models. And the clustering is based on the linguistic identity of the sound. So vowels that have a similar kind of linguistic structure will be clustered together. So we actually use decision trees to tie states in the models. And that's one of the ways we get the number of parameters down. And I actually thought I had slides in here. I guess I didn't have the slides on language modeling. So language modeling, I used to have a slide that showed with the game Wheel of Fortune. Yeah, if you've been in the U.S. long enough, so have our foreign students had a chance to enjoy Wheel of Fortune, one of the great American games? Right? No, you've not seen? None of you have seen Wheel of Fortune? Well, this is actually kind of interesting, because this is something which exists in some languages and doesn't exist in others. So Wheel of Fortune is a game where you are told how many letters there are in a word, and then you eventually guess at the letters, and the person who wins the game is the person who eventually guesses what the overall word is. Now, why does this work in English? You can play Wheel of Fortune or Hangman or whatever you want to call it in English. Why? So what's the word here? There's a few. You could have tail. You could have what? tall. You could have talk. That was actually the word I was thinking about when I wrote it. So English is a language which has, where words are constructed from letters, and we have this wonderful notion of spelling. Now, other languages that don't really have that, Japanese, for example, and Chinese, for example, which are based on kanji characters and are considered logographic languages, don't necessarily have that property. Though, in Japanese, a sentence will be written as a string of kanji characters, but they will not have word boundaries. And you have to look at the characters and group them kind of mentally to figure out where words are. And I don't remember, does Chinese have word boundaries when Chinese is written? Do you put spaces between words in Chinese? I don't think so, right? No, right? It's just a sentence. You have an end of sentence marker like a... But you can look at the combinations of characters and figure out which ones go together. And Chinese is more syllabic than Japanese, from what I understand. So you can pronounce each character in Chinese just by looking at the character. In Japanese, you actually have, the pronunciation depends on the grouping of characters. So you have to know how to group the characters. And there are about 2,000 kanji characters in Japanese that are used on a daily basis. They're what's used typically in newspapers and media and things. But there's about 20,000 overall kanji characters. Some of them occur very rarely, are used to describe historical events or figures or that were old words or things. So when I went to Japan, I was surprised in getting to know the young Japanese. A lot of young Japanese, you could give them, we had pulled up some text from some historical literature because we were looking for text to train on. And I asked this young Japanese to read that text. They couldn't read it because they didn't know what these characters meant, because they were less common characters that they really weren't trained on. And that was really interesting to me, because in English, we can look at spelling and we can sort of figure out what the word is. You can't do that in Japanese. If you don't know the character, you don't know the character. Now, I think Chinese isn't quite that bad, right? Chinese has a well-defined set of characters from which all words are built, right? And the total number of kanji characters in Chinese are, I think, smaller than what are used in Japanese. It's more syllabic, as I understand it. But anyway, so in these kinds of languages, so we have a number of foreign students here, you didn't have to learn spelling when you grew in elementary school, but you had to memorize characters. Well, in English, we have this whole concept of spelling bees. So it's like a whole culture, right? You all, especially if you come from this area of the country where they have these. Well, why does this work? Well, this works because you can look at the relationship between letters, and we know that certain letters cannot occur in English. For example, a word will not have five consonants in a row. I don't believe there's any word that has five consonants. And certain consonant clusters, like str, are very unique, and that you can almost determine the word based on the presence of that cluster in itself. And in fact, you can take text and you can delete characters, and people can still read the text and understand it. There's a lot of redundancy. So this is what language modeling does. It makes use of this kind of redundancy to predict the next word. Because it turns out there's a lot of redundancy in language, and I can use that redundancy to predict words. So with language modeling, we also build state machines that sort of, given n previous words, can predict the next word. And then we use that to influence our probabilities in our overall Bayesian formulation. They've done a lot of experiments like that, and they're all, you know, really interesting how well people can understand things even when the text is corrupted to a fairly high degree. Machines are pretty good at memorizing letter combinations. You have spell checkers and things these days that are pretty good, but word combinations is another story. And the bottom line on that is that words language is constantly evolving from a word point of view. Every year, Webster's adds 20 to or so new words to the language. And the words that are most probable today are not necessarily the words that were most probable 10 years ago. So Obama, for example, you'll see that word a lot now. You didn't see that 5 years ago. And I always love when events, world events happen, new words are created by the news channels and CNN and all that kind of stuff, right? I mean, this is actually now a part of language that when event happens, people race to be the first one to coin a term to capture that, right? You were saying? Main Street, and we had blue and red states, and it's just hilarious because now, and think of what this is doing to speech recognition systems, because these are words we have to know if we want our systems to work well. So language is a constantly very dynamic thing, and that's why we have to have adaptation strategies. Okay, well, we're out of time. You can look through the slides. There's a lot of pointers to more resources. But hopefully, you know, you've learned a lot this semester and been exposed to a lot of different technologies. Okay, see you on Monday.